Hello and welcome to show number 2 in the series of podcasts by Bill Gwynn and Group Effort Sound Studios. On this show, we continue our interview with longtime music business veteran Ron Esposito. Okay, so at some point you decide to not do the management thing anymore for PM Records. What precipitated your exit from there?
I tell you, financial problems.
the labels?
Yeah, the problems? Label, right. I tell you what. Being in the independent record business, and particularly at that time in the early 80s, this is pre-computer, all that stuff,
right.
Okay? You had what's called independent distribution. So, you know, you had a guy like in the San Francisco Bay Area, Rick Ballard Imports was the guy. Then you'd have a guy out of Chicago and a guy out of New York, you know, the regional record distribution, okay? And slow pay would kill you. I mean, they would sell your product, but would hold on to the money until you started crying for it and threatening
to not send any more.
Yeah, or legal action, you know? And that's just the nature of the independent record distribution business, which, interestingly enough, hardly doesn't even exist anymore. I mean, you have some regional wholesalers and stuff like that. But, you know, the day of the independent jazz record distributor, I don't even know if that even exists anymore, to tell you the truth. And the independent record business is such a hard scrabble business that, and particularly a jazz label, I mean, you do this because you love it. You ain't doing it because you're trying to become a millionaire. But to be, we just weren't selling enough records to keep the whole ship afloat. So,
Did the label go out of business or did it
it did.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it went out of business. You know, when the ship started sinking, it sunk pretty fast.
Yeah.
So, fortunately, it wasn't a big payroll. I was the only guy on the payroll.
So, so they can't make that. You're really a drunk.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. So it was time for me to, you know, decide what I was going to do again. You know, and, you know, it's funny. I could have stayed in New York, obviously, because I had connections, you know. But I didn't, you know. I wanted to go back to Athens, Ohio again.
Was it a city-country kind of thing? I mean, you just can only take the intensity of Manhattan for so long? Or?
That might be. You know, I can remember. I remembered one time feeling literally like I was in a concrete canyon in New York, particularly during the summertime. Whoa. You know, and, you know, New York on an everyday basis, you know, if you're taking the subways every day and you're mixing it up with the millions upon millions of other people, it can be a little hard.
Yeah.
You know?
It's also, it seems to me, it would be a little confining if you don't really have a car. You find yourself on the same pathways all the time.
You don't range very far. And, you know, Bill, that's really well said. Because everybody, at least in regard to New York, you think, oh, it's such a big city. Well, Bill, you made a great point. You really don't live in the whole city. You only really live and operate in your neighborhood for the most part. I mean, you might go to work wherever, you know. I went to Rockefeller Plaza when I worked for CTI, or I go to, you know, Midtown to the studios. But, yeah, you don't live in the whole city. You live in your neighborhood. And I lived on the Lower East Side at 2nd Avenue and 11th Street. So that was my neighborhood. The guys I saw, I used to see the New York Dolls. That's who I see all the time because they lived on St. Mark's Place. And we used to go to the Gem Spa on the corner of 2nd Avenue and St. Mark's Place, you know. And there it was. That was the neighborhood. So you knew the people in the neighborhood, the crazies as well as the notoriety and regular people, you know.
So Athens pops up.
Yeah, Athens pops up again. I had the opportunity.
It's familiar.
Yeah, it's familiar. Yeah, I was like a ping pong ball in and out of Athens, Ohio for years and years. Athens was a very, very important, very special place for me. I did a lot of my life transitioning in Athens. So again, I'm getting ready by 1981 or some point in 81 or go back to Athens. A friend of mine was selling his used book and record store. I was kind of looking to, you know, kick back a little bit, shall we say. You know, living in New York is intense. And I'm an absolute guy who's in the intensity, okay? I've got a lot of intensity. But I felt I needed a little break. I bought this guy's used book and record store. It was a place called Haffa's, H-A-F-F-A, apostrophe S.
Make sure you get that apostrophe in the right place.
That's right, yeah. Man, if I want to do business with John Hammond.
That's right.
Exactly. And it was a used book and record store down in the basement of a restaurant.
Yeah. Well, what did that set you back? Just curious.
I bought it for $15,000.
Yeah.
In 1981.
Okay, so all of a sudden you're a retail establishment.
Yeah,
owner.
I'm in retail now. Whoa.
So
that's a whole other trip.
Oh, absolutely.
That is really a whole other, because you know what happens in retail?
What?
You're only as good as your inventory. I mean, it's a no-brainer.
Well, sure, but
that's really
but
the deal.
You don't get a chance to choose your inventory all that well.
That's right. That's dead on. And I'm in a college town.
Right.
So 85% of my clientele, college kids. Nothing wrong with that. Hey, their money's right. Green as anybody else's, okay? You know, and I made a pretty good living down there, okay? But what I did find, now, I only dealt used product. Now, I did buy some cutouts from, like, Scorpio and, you know, these cutout dealers. You know, and I was real knowledgeable about record labels, so I knew what I was buying. I would sell some of, like, the CBS midline stuff, you know, stuff that you could buy sealed for $250 and sell for $399. And then selling used records. And, you know, you get your biggest markup on the used stuff. So, one, you got to learn what to buy.
Right. Right.
You know,
I'm not taking that Chipmunks record. No
yeah,
way.
Right, exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. Unless it's Christmas time and it's that Christmas Chipmunks
right,
thing,
right.
Okay?
Okay. Which is huge, beyond belief.
Yeah, really, yeah. You know. So one of the biggest things is right is just learning what to buy for your clientele and what to pay for stuff. Now, the interesting thing is in that kind of business in a college town, I get older every year, but my clientele stays the same age.
Right. Oh, interesting.
Dig?
Yeah.
You
yeah.
dig?
Yeah.
So I owned that used book and record store, I don't know, for about maybe 6 or 7 years. I don't know. After about the third year in, I figured out, you know, I'm getting older and my musical tastes and interests are getting further and further away from.
So we're about 1986 now?
Well, that's toward, yeah, I think I sold the store in 86, yeah.
Right, so CDs yeah. have been invented.
Yeah, and actually that's what spurred me to get out because I was going to have to recapitalize my whole operation.
Recapitalize meaning you're going to have to get rid of the vinyl and get all CDs.
Right, in. Right, because yeah. the writing was on the wall, man. Yeah.
Just and I understand now the reasons why, but I was surprised at the time just exactly how quickly, how so immediately vinyl just disappeared. It was just somebody flipped a switch.
Yeah, yeah. That's
so
what happened.
My theory is that because you can make a CD to a much higher standard of quality than you could a vinyl record.
Yeah.
When you were in the labels, wasn't it somewhere like 15% to 30% returns?
Yeah, there was high return. I mean, vinyl, of course.
And that's a total
warped,
loss for the label, right?
Mismanufactured. Yeah.
Yeah.
With CDs, it's a rarity that there's any.
It's one out of 100,000.
Yeah.
That.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So the labels see a way to get 15%. Better product right off the top.
Oh, yeah.
So they just dumped vinyl with a passion.
They did. Right? They really, really, really did. And what's interesting now, it seems vinyl has made somewhat of a comeback amongst some segment of the music listening public, okay? I mean, it's never going to overtake CDs again. But, yeah, that's what happened. Vinyl went just like that.
Did you see that it was going to go that fast when it first came out?
No.
Or it just happened and you were in it? And
no, yeah,
holy
it just
shit.
Happened. It just happened, and all I knew is if I was going to stay in business, I was going to have to recapitalize, change my whole operation over. And I tell you what, baby, I wasn't up for it.
So did you find somebody to buy it?
Yeah, I found somebody to buy my store.
Well, that's good.
And at that point, I decided I was going to leave Athens again. And move to Cincinnati with my intention of becoming the music director for WVXU-FM at Xavier University.
You had heard from some people that you knew that were there that they needed somebody to do a job there that didn't exist.
Yeah, I heard from some of my people that I'd met in Cincinnati that were associated with WVXU and that, you know, heard my radio work and liked my pipes and knew that I knew the music. Because it's interesting, my wife at the time wanted to move back to Colorado. I wasn't quite ready to make that leap because I wasn't connected in that part of the world. So I kind of struck a little deal with my wife at the time.
Would have been a full ground zero thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I struck a little deal with my wife at the time. I said, let's move to Cincinnati. I'm going to get a job at WVXU. They don't know it yet, but I am. And we'll take all our vacations in Colorado. And she went for it.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah. And it's interestingly enough, just as a little footnote, when I got married, I went into the back room of my record store, pulled a bunch of records, drove to Columbus, Ohio, went to see the captain at Singing Dog Records, who was one of the first guys to really understand the Europeans and the Japanese were into American records and would pay for them. Oh, yes. The Japanese, we thank you a lot. Thank you. Yes. And I walked out of there with $1,500 cash. And
you knew in advance that this was going to happen?
I knew in advance that I was going to make some money.
Right.
Because the money I was going to get up there was going to pay for my wedding, which was kind of a stripped down wedding, but it was enough, you know. So that's what I did. I always viewed my record collection as my bank account. So we moved to Cincinnati. My wife starts looking for a job in the social work realm. I still had connections with some distributors. You know, while I was making my inroads at WVXU, I was selling cassettes at flea markets on the weekends, you know, nice price cassettes, sealed Aerosmith for $3.99, you know, that kind of
stuff. Not boots, but
just... Oh, no, not boots, right. Yeah. It was called midline product. So I kept trying to contact the general manager at WVXU.
Who was?
Dr. Jim King at the time. A real radio visionary. So I'm having some difficulty in getting a luncheon or a meeting with Dr. King, you know, to kind of pitch myself, okay? Even though these friends of mine at VXU had told him about me. So I had to get ingenious.
Oh, I can't wait.
And which I did.
Okay.
So what I did is... I started listening to WVXU in what's called day parts. You have morning drive from 6 a.m. till 10 a.m.
Sure, standard slot.
Right. And then you have, you know, your late morning, and then you go into the afternoon, and then you have afternoon drive, then you have early evening, and then you've got the overnights, you know, this kind of stuff, okay? So what I did... was over a 2-week period, I listened to all the day parts of WVXU X number of times. And I did a critical analysis of all the components from the announce styles of the disc jockeys to the music that was played to the quality of production to the placement of underwriting spots, the whole Megillah. I came up with like a 25 or 30 page report just like I was back in grad school. And I made a couple copies, mailed one off to Dr. Jim King. And I said, hey, after you read this, call me up. I know we'll have a lot to talk about. And he read it.
He read it?
Oh, yeah. He read it. And he called me immediately.
That must have been gratifying.
It was very gratifying.
Because when a guy who won't take your appointment takes the time to read a 25-page document and then calls you, you know it had to be the day he received it. You know, that means you totally nailed it.
Yeah. And he was very interested in the things that I observed because I was a third-party observer. I wasn't working there. Right. They weren't paying me.
Right. You had no reason not to be honest.
Right, exactly. Right. I was telling it like I heard it, you know? He hired me. Boom, like that. And I think it was like 86 or 87 that I got hired. I got hired as the music director. I supervised all of the on-air staff, did all the business with the record companies, auditioned all the music that was played on the air, except for the night waves, you know, punk rock stuff right. That was going on at that time. I started branching off into CD production.
Because VXU sponsored a number of local CDs.
Right, exactly. And of course, that was new technology. And Jim King was all about new technology. In fact, we started recording digitally off of the Spectrum on videotape.
Oh, yeah.
With the PCM units.
Right, the PCM units.
Yeah, right, exactly. Moved up to DAT recording after that. You know, and I also got into promoting concerts for the radio station, most notably the Windham Hill Winter Solstice Tours. Interestingly enough.
So this was kind of like the culmination of all of this stuff that you had been doing all at the time. You're at the radio station, but you're still doing concerts. Mm-hmm. You're still interfacing with the record company. You're still dealing with artists.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. It's interesting how it all comes together in a different environment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the Hyatt Hotel downtown have been doing a jazz series called Jazz Live from the Hyatt, which initially WGUC had been sponsoring.
It's a 13-week
series.
Yeah,
during the wintertime,
Every Saturday night, live on the radio for 2 hours from 10 to 12. I was doing the live sound for that.
Exactly, right.
And at some point, the whole radio sponsorship of it ended, but the hotel still wanted it to keep on going.
Right.
So you came in as the promoter, musician, liaison.
Right, exactly.
To run it
booking
as if
agent.
It was a club date.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
And you didn't fire me, which I really appreciate.
No, heck no. Hey, if it ain't broke, you don't need to fix it. You know what I'm saying? And actually, that was the beginning of a very good relationship between you and I, both as friends and as me starting to make records at your studio. So I started doing Jazz Live from the Hyatt, and you know, I'd bring in some national artists with a mix of local and regional artists. And also, for about 8 years, I booked a summertime blues series out of Coney Island, which was a gas because, I mean, I got to bring in some of the greatest blues artists, Albert Collins, Buddy Guy.
I did that show.
Yeah. Ronnie Earl, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. List goes on and on and on. Just, you know, music, the music business, anything ancillary to that. It was my life from when I got out of college and maybe starting even at age 10, you know. Yeah. Over the past 3 years since the sale of WVXU, my life is a little different, and that's fine.
You're talking about doing a lot of blues.
Yeah.
Because when you came back, you started playing again.
Yeah, I did.
Right. And got hooked up with a local blues artist.
Yeah. In fact, in the early 90s, I got hooked up with a really, really good electric and acoustic blues guitar player, great, strong singer, and a very good writer by the name of Greg Schauber. Greg and I played together for almost 15 years, believe it or not. And we recorded four records with that group, the various forms of that group. all of which our dear friend.
That's right. One of them was a live album, too.
We did it. The last one was a live record, and we did three studio records with Bill.
All of which were just a pleasure to work on.
Yeah. Well, you know, we were a good band, and particularly the later version of the group was probably its strongest version. And, you know, we worked regionally, you know, Chicago, Memphis, Indianapolis, you know, all over the place.
Right. Now, you didn't really have any representation.
No, I took care of the business for that.
Right. So at this point, you now have got the new hat of agent. You're a full-time agent for the band.
I'm dealing with primarily bar owners and special events producers. My motto was, it ain't personal, okay? I.e., I'm not going to die or cry if you don't book my band, but I will call you incessantly until you say yes or no. So you have to say yes or no.
Yeah.
And if you say no, hey, fine, because you know what? You'll probably end up booking us at some point.
In the future, right.
And in the future.
I'll call you again, but after a gap.
Yeah, right. And once somebody said yes to us, we generally were in that club's regular rotation once you heard the band live. Because we were as good as anybody out there doing this.
And you played music that people could relate to.
Right.
And anybody who wanted to hear anything like what you guys did would say, yeah, this is the real deal.
Yeah, this is the real deal, which I'm very grateful for. And
so I would imagine that given your vast experience in the business, you've seen every way it can go wrong and also understand how to do it right. So there was no doubt that you would present yourself as a group in a professional way.
Absolutely.
So what did that really entail? Approach people, what do you need?
What that really entailed meant, one, a professionally done-looking promotional package, which included 8x10 glossy photo of the group, professional bio material, press clippings, contact information, and a nicely put-together, branded-looking package, okay?
Meaning this is a folder that contained all
Exactly. Of course, these days, all of this is done digitally online now. You have your online promo kit.
Right.
But for most of the years that I was out there playing the clubs, it was a real promo kit with an audition demo tape or demo CD. 3 to 5 tunes excerpted so the bar owner or special events person could hear what you sounded like. And of course,
You guys played almost all original music, right?
Yeah, we did, which was a real exception for the kind of genre we were working in. Yeah, we probably played 75% original music.
So no Mustang Sally, and, well, at least not
unless, you know, we were playing somebody's whatever, and there was a request,
right,
you know what I'm saying.
If you're a cover band, that whole idea of doing the excerpts of the songs is good. You're trying to get people to understand that it's the range of material that you do that's important, not the fact that you can play the song all the way through.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, this is the kind of stuff that we do, and we'll put a lot of it on there, but you don't really need to hear more than a verse and a chorus.
And that's dead on. I mean, look, in all honesty, if the bar owner even listens to the demo stuff, that's really going the extra mile, you know?
On his part.
On his part or her part. So, I mean, always conducted myself professionally on the telephone, called people at the times when they asked for callbacks.
How did you manage that? Did you keep make sure?
Put in your calendar.
Yeah.
Put in your date book.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, hey, I was making a living from this.
Give it the highest priority.
Yeah, right. I was making a living from this. You know, I was getting paid to do this. This was not a pastime, a hobby. This was part of my profession, particularly because I left full-time employment with WVXU in 1992. And after that point, I worked as an independent producer. So income from playing with the band was very important. In fact, at one point, the guitar player said, "Hey, man, can you slow down on the booking? Because I still have a day job, and I'm going to die if you keep us working the way that we're working." Yeah. You know, it's also important that you get to the gig on time, that you're set up in time, that you come self-contained, that your equipment is working and maintained, and that
no drama,
let's like chill on the ego stuff. The customers and bar owners will provide all the drama that you'll ever need, believe me. Okay.
So true.
We also had a little deal, you know, that we didn't drink or any of that stuff.
An agreement amongst yourselves in the band?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you could have maybe a beer or two, but that was about it. I mean, we were not going to be altered because, look, people were paying money to come see us.
And you can't get sloppy at the end of the show.
No, right. And right. I mean, we prided ourselves on being tight, rehearsed, and slamming. When you're like that, people will pay attention to you, you know? I do recall, after all the years, you know, of promoting and producing and working in New York, et cetera, Boston, I remember playing my first club date with the band at some bar and going in and having to run the whole band and the PA off of one plug. It was like,
it's a good thing you didn't have lights.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You would have been playing the gig acoustically in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. And it was really interesting. I really had to observe myself. I almost threw a hissy fit. Like, what is this? You know what I'm saying? But hey, if you play in bars and you play in clubs, that's the deal.
Yeah.
So you learn to bring six bangers with you.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not only that. It's when you go into a situation, it's an art form to go in and scope out exactly what you've got available to it and then adjust on the fly to fit the situation that you're dealt with that night.
That is so well stated, Bill. In fact, musicians, they're some of the most adaptable, go-with-the-flow people you'll ever meet in your life. Because they got to be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a completely fluid thing.
Right. I mean, until you're Madonna, Celine Dion, or whoever.
And you've got Ron Esposito working for
right,
you.
Right, yeah. You've got
sure
a guy like
right.
Ron Esposito writing your contracts.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah. So when you're dealing with club owners and stuff, what are the things that the club owners do that are as predictable and frustrating?
One, they will never return your phone calls. I mean, unless you actually are booked and playing there regularly, okay? Because then you kind of have a relationship.
Right.
But initially, if you're trying to break into the place, you can leave a million messages, and generally they will not return your phone calls just because they don't know. There's 50 other people just like you trying to get the gig. So
what you're saying is you have to be persistent. It's up to you to make contact.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. I mean, unless you're playing with a band that's so hot that everybody knows you and wants to book you, you know what I'm saying? Bar owners are in the bar business. They pay attention to, you know, how much their liquor is costing them, and they're not in the music business.
It's kind of a nuisance in a way to them.
Well, yeah, because they got to deal.
Necessary nuisance.
Yeah, they got to deal with these musicians who aren't their employees, but they're paying them.
Right, right.
And so probably the biggest thing aside from club owners not returning phone calls, the perennial volume business.
Oh, you know, the band's too loud.
The band's too loud.
Yeah.
And, you know, folks, sometimes the band is too loud.
Well, yeah.
It's the truth sometimes. Sometimes it's not a matter of volume, but it's a matter of presence. That I find. There's ways to get the sound balanced and to be able to play a variety of places.
I think one of the keys for a group like yours, and I think this was borne out experimentally, find a way to make your amp point at you so you can hear it well and let the PA, if any, take care of it. And you'll be able to play pretty much as loud as you want without blowing people away in the bar.
Yeah,
so you
right.
You find you're constantly feeling like you can't play the way you want to play.
Well, yeah, you definitely want to let the PA do the work. There's no doubt of that.
Yeah, I mean, I see so many guys that just are toasting the backs of their knees with their amp, but they can't hear it because they're standing right next to it and they're up above it. So yeah, get an amp stand, lean that sucker back.
And also, you know, a good monitor mix speaks volumes. So, yeah, you know, getting the stage sound in a proper balance is very important. You know, I was fortunate in all the years that we played the beer joints and special events, we never got stiffed on the money.
Is that because you were playing at a high enough level that—
I guess so, or the places were we were playing were reputable enough or had halfway decent bands playing in there.
So you never had to chase anybody?
No, we never did. I remember one event or a couple. You know, the people putting it on were a little amateurish and—
Like a church festival
or
something.
Yeah, right, a church festival, very well stated.
Yeah.
And they would get hammered by the weather, and they just could not believe that they still have to pay you. You know, it's like, well, you know, this is called an act of God, and we were here.
And as
here,
church people, you should understand
this. Right. And we were here, and we were set up and ready to play, and we actually played some tunes, but because— You didn't provide the canopy that was in the contract
right.
in case of rain.
So I will not be standing in any puddle playing electric guitar.
Right, yeah, being right. electrocuted.
Right.
We get all the money. And, you know, in a few of those instances, you know, you settle for half the money.
But you have no recourse if you don't have that in writing.
Yeah, really. And I'm going to say, for the most part, in reality, I don't think you have much recourse anyway, unless you want to try to sue somebody.
Did you make it an effort to have a written contract for every show?
No.
When would a written contract be the thing?
We used written contracts for special events, concerts, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
But on bar gigs, I don't know anybody who ever used a contract. At least in the circle that we played in.
Yeah. Did you have problems with last-minute cancellations or things like that?
Every once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean—
Do you just have to take it?
That's just part of playing the beer joints. Because I tell you what, you're going to get in some bar owner's face? I tell you what happens. Nothing happens.
You don't get the money, and he never hires you again.
That's exactly what happens. Right.
Oh, okay.
Because what happens is people make mistakes. And bar owners will double book on occasion. And, you know, whether it's because they're not paying attention or whatever, they'll make mistakes. Hey, I'm not going to say I ever double booked the band, but I'm sure that happens sometimes too. Very rarely. It's more on the club owner's part that somebody gets double booked.
There are very few groups that are so in demand that they can actually play two gigs simultaneously.
Yeah, that's exactly right, baby. Though when I was 14 years old, I did book two gigs for the same night. I was lucky I did because the first one didn't work out too good, so we got to go to the second
one. Good to have a gig in the hall.
Yeah, exactly. I tell you what, in all the years that we played, 15 years of playing in the joints, it probably only happened 5 times.
Well, it also helps to have more than a couple of gigs a month so that you don't lose 50% of your
income. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
8%. The object of being a professional musician is to play as often and regularly as possible.
Yeah. So, you guys played a lot of the same stuff, right? You had all your original compositions.
Yeah.
I mean, and you had a lot of them, but you didn't have hundreds of original compositions.
Yeah, right.
How did you deal with the monotony that can come from playing the same music at the same place for the 57th time?
It seemed, for the most part, that every time we played, we approached it like this was the last time we were ever going to play. So even though we played the tune 10,000 times, we played it like, you know, this was the last time we were ever going to play.
Yeah. Well, Greg is like that. Greg, the leader of the band.
Right. And I'm kind of like that too. I think sometimes the drummers, you know, may have
sandbagged a little.
Yeah, right. But Greg and I can say never. I can't ever recall us ever not. Though it's a point well made. On occasion, I would talk with the leader of the band, you know, saying, you know, until you bring in some fresh new material, why don't we pull up some cover stuff that, you know, we can just play.
Though, you know, I've been playing in the same salsa band now for 10 years, and the thing that gets me is, like, you know, there's always some aspect of the tune that you can play better, even if it's a tiny, tiny little something that nobody would ever really hear. But you know that in that intro to that tune, you didn't ping every note exactly perfectly time and in pitch.
I mean,
there's something you can do to make it better. And I think, focus on that, and then you don't get bored.
And I would agree with that. And I would also say we played blues-oriented music, which is really all about raw, emotional hookup, that kind of thing.
Communication with the listener.
Communication, right. And me and the guitar player had no shortage of that. Because, you know, if you try to play blues-oriented music, light and polite, it doesn't work too well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, obviously. You know? Yeah, that's a point well taken. Present from the emotional impact of what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the listener, that's what attracts the listener. Then, you know, if they're a little more sophisticated, they might pick up on, oh, yeah, man, that horn player, really, you know, he knows his X, Y, Z, that kind of stuff. But the immediate draw is, are they feeling it?
Exactly.
You know, that's the deal, man.
Okay, so a couple of things happened. Greg decided to go on an acoustic thing. He's got some stuff.
Right.
And has put out a couple of CDs of acoustic
stuff. Yeah, very good stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the two public radio stations in town decide to fight it out.
Oh, yeah.
And one of them, WGUC, the classical music station, absorbs WVXU.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which, from a radio business standpoint, made perfect sense to me. However, there were certain aspects of WVXU that people liked that aren't as well served by them being an all-NPR, all-the-time kind of station.
Exactly.
But nevertheless, WVXU isn't promoting any more concerts as such.
No, they're not doing...
You know, and you did the Riders in the Sky thing for
shows. For years and years. Boy, those guys are great players.
Oh, yeah. And I was lucky to do sound for several of those when they did that, and that was always a treat. I still can't get over the fact that the yodeling cowboy fiddler has a PhD in physics.
Yeah, yeah, Woody Paul.
That just kills me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'd go on the road with those guys every once in a while and do their merchandising, you know, when their merch guy couldn't make it or whatever. And it was pretty interesting being on the bus with those guys. You know, in fact...
it's great being around that level of talent.
Yeah, it is. And you know what's interesting? When you're around that level of talent, they always make it look so easy. They make it look effortless. You know, it's incredible.
But nevertheless, so they had their 100 shows, they're in syndication. So you ended up taking a whole new change in direction.
Yeah, you know, I've reinvented myself a few times in my adult life. You know, most of it's been around the music business, okay, and radio, that type of thing.
So tell us, what is your job description today?
Today, I am a certified life coach in practice at the Conscious Living Center up in Mount Auburn.
Nothing having to do with the music business as such.
No, but you know, it's interesting though. I'm finding a way back in, buddy. and a lot of my work deals with spiritual development, personal growth, consciousness expansion.
So how did you decide to get to this?
Actually,
I'm really interested in the path that you go from being, call it, musically unemployed.
Yeah, yeah.
What made you decide? You had obviously had to get some training or some certification.
Yeah, yeah. I took a two-year program,
So what led you there?
Running through underneath everything in my life starting at age 22 has been a deep spiritual connection, philosophic, metaphysical connection to all that is. And I've been a student of spirituality and consciousness since I've been 22. I'm 57 now. For people who get to know me very well, they start to know this about me. So that has been a thread that's run through everything. In fact, about the last 7 years on WVXU, I did a spiritual talk show with a good friend of mine, Richard Francis. And, we talked about spirituality, metaphysics, consciousness, these types of things, which have always been of interest to me through whatever I've done. So when WVXU got sold and I didn't get picked up by the new operation, it was time, Ron, what are you going to do now? Okay. I've been kind of weaning away from playing the beer joints. After you play the beer joints enough with enough regularity, you need a little break from them too.
Right.
I really, to be quite honest, Bill, I did the proverbial listened to my heart. I wanted to work in an arena where my spirituality, where my interest in consciousness really came to the fore.
Instead of being the subtext.
Right. Instead of being the subtext, it becomes the major text now. So I took a 2-year program through the School of Conscious Living that Dr. Deborah Ooten operates from the Conscious Living Center, which certified me as a life coach and also certified me in the use of a personality tool called the Enneagram. And the Enneagram excels at showing our unconscious and habitual ways of thinking, feeling, and behaving. And it serves as an aid in us developing the self-observing faculty so that we can kind of see our patterns and then we can go about changing if we so choose to do so. And it has a little more spiritual content than the Myers-Briggs, so that appeals to me. The Enneagram goes from dealing with the ego fixations of personality all the way to what's called the holy ideas, which are called the antidote to the ego fixations of personality.
Right. So the Enneagram, as I understand it, is 9 major personality types.
That's right.
With 3 subtypes for each of the 9.
That's right. Very okay. Good. That's exactly right. Yeah. In fact, you were involved in a very lengthy recording project that we did on the Enneagram and how people use money. And it was a lot of people talking. And a lot of editing.
27 interviews about money.
Yeah, 27 interviews about money and editing them.
But it was very demonstrative at the end.
Yeah,
when
it was. Yeah, you did. Right. Yeah. They all sounded like geniuses when we got done with the editing. But, it's interesting with this work I'm doing now in consciousness and spirituality, I'm starting to apply some music now or sound in this realm. I got a set of crystal quartz singing bowls.
Oh, okay. And, sure. Well, and what a pure sound that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I have a set of Tibetan brass singing bowls that form the complete G major scale.
Watch out for F sharp.
I have an F sharp bowl. Yeah. Actually, I want to pick up an F bowl too so that I can.
So you can be dominant.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. And I also play the bowls in tandem with the imbira, the African thumb piano, the kalimba, right. Which happens also to be in the key of G. So I'm offering sound.
So do you combine the capability of sound to conjure up an image or a concept? Do you?
Yeah. It's interesting, right? I do actually a meditation on the holy ideas of the Enneagram, where I use spoken word, the crystal and brass bowls with the kalimba in a complete kind of presentation. Mm-hmm. I'm also offering—
Do you do this one-on-one or is it for a group?
No, I usually for a group, with okay. A group, yeah. And then on some Saturday mornings, I offer sound meditation, where basically it's just me doing the bowls, and people approach it from a meditative point of view, where they sit or lay quietly, as you might in meditation, and you use the sound of the bowls as the thing that you kind of pay bare attention to, you know, that type
right,
of thing.
Right, so you're not fighting against the complete silence of the room.
Right, right, right.
Whatever kind of activity you have going on in your mind.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
Right, yeah, the sound of the bowls is used as a focal point. And I tell you what, these things are very, very powerful in their resonance, particularly when you get them singing. Because like you said, they're, yeah, they're pure tones. You know, I know how to form chords. You know, I can play the G, B, and D to get a G major chord and get them all happening, or play an E minor chord, and you know, this type
right,
of thing.
Right.
You know, so they're quite something. And in fact, I'm looking forward to doing a recording here at Group Effort
in this very room, perhaps.
In this very room, yeah, perhaps, with the bowls and you know, some other instruments, tabla, cello.
You know, it's interesting. I ran across a lady. One of my clients is a person who plays Native American Indian flutes.
Yes, we would like to use that as well.
Right. And she discovered that her neighbor has this amazing set of handmade German gongs.
Oh, wow.
Hanging gongs. And they rigged up a suspension bar across a couple of speaker stands.
Yeah.
And they put them up there, and you hit these things, and it has that amazing pure sound of the metal plate. And we did a video of it and put it up on YouTube recently.
Oh, cool.
So search for a relaxation gong show.
Yeah, right, because those things have a resonance and a pure tonal quality that if you just tune into it, it's like a tractor beam that just pulls you into the sound, and it's beautiful. I mean, it is really beautiful.
Yeah, there's something so inviting and stark about the purity of the tone.
Right, that's exactly right. There's a stark purity of the tone, and in fact, in the Hindu tradition, it's called nada yoga. It means basically the yoga of sound.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, Bill, the brass and the crystal singing bowls, the notes correspond to the different chakras or energy centers that are in the body. So it's pretty interesting. There's a very large hookup with these beyond their own pristine sound, you know, that type of thing.
Well, that's great. Well, Ron, I can't thank you enough for stopping by and having this extremely lengthy but highly entertaining conversation with us. And I'm sure everybody that listens to this will be fascinated because it's a great story.
Yeah, you've only heard half of it.
I know. Well, we're going to have, you know, maybe if we get some callbacks on this, you know, from the world at large, we'll come back. Okay, now it's road stories.
Yeah, road stories. So, yeah, we can get into, like, well, why was Miles Davis not always on time getting up there to play? So anyway.
We're going to have to do this once a week then, I can
tell. Hey, I'd be okay by me. I like recording
the
studios.
The Bill and Ron show. We'll make sure
we keep
the lights.
Yeah, I got a big mouth, too.
Yeah.